Okay, we're just about to start. Just about 1 minute, picking up from finishing up chapter 6 of the Anchorholics. So just 1 minute. Hi, good morning, everybody.
There he is. Good morning.
Okay, a little technical problem. We had a server issue this week. We had a crash, and not everything evidently is installed. So I just realized at this moment that the online would not be able to get the audio. So I just wanted to give them a heads up to dial in. So it took a few minutes longer. But hopefully they'll join the online, the phone class for today until we get everything fixed up on the server. Okay. So we're up to a number of very cryptic verses that will conclude chapter 6. So let's read through them. We're going to read 10, 11, and 12, the last three verses. And it's a good place to end over there, not because it's the end of the chapter, but because the next verse, which is 7:1, goes into positive statements. We're here, King Solomon is discussing incorrect ideas. Okay. Let's make sure everybody online has got the right number. How's everybody doing there? Doug, Cal, Ruka, Francesca, Josh?
Jim.
Jim's all too.
Jim, hey, what's doing?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so hopefully they'll join us. All right, why don't we start? Again, sorry for the delay. All right, well, I'm going to read over here. And this is, again, these verses are, I think, of all the verses we've done so far, very, very cryptic. But let's see if we can unravel them. Okay, so King Solomon continues, and he says, that which already exists, its name has been called to it, and it is known by man. Again, I'm just reading loosely. Or it is known that he is man. Maybe to mean... Right. It is known that it is known perhaps because he is man. We'll have to see what that means. And then he seems to switch gears as to what the idea is. And he says, and man is not able to go into judgment with one that is more powerful than he. Strange verse. Masha Hayikavar, that which was already called its name, and it's known. Vinoda Asherhu Adam, and it is known inasmuch as he is man. And he, meaning man, cannot judge or contend. He can't go to judgment with one that is more powerful than him. Sounds like a bunch of two ideas that are very disparate. What's the relationship between the first and the end? Then he goes on and he says, for there are many matters that are increased to futility. What benefit is there to man? Again, there are many matters that for, and he starts off this verse 11, and he says, for, meaning he's a continuing this thought. Like if you start off a verse and you say the word because, you can't start off a book because. You can't start off a verse because, unless it's continuing on a previous thought. It's trying to explain a previous statement. Because there are many matters that increase the futility. And what benefit is there to man? And then the last verse also starts with because. Because who knows what good is there to man in his life? The few days, the few numbered days of his life of futility, that he should do them as a shadow. And who is there that will tell man what will happen afterwards under the sun? All right, everybody completely confused yet?
Yeah.
Very.
Right? And if the Torah has to be learned in process, he is clearly showing that here, that without applying thought, it's unravel. So you can't really get to the truth. The real truth is is really hidden behind a veil for most people. So if there's one thing that we do learn from the cryptic style and the metaphors, yes, hello.
Hi, this is Tina.
Hello, Tina. How are you? Glad you got together. We had a problem with the service.
Yes.
There's probably no sound on the website, right?
Yes, no sound, yes.
Right. Okay, so we'll have it fixed hopefully this week. And then we'll go back to the regular. All right?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so Tina, just take a look. We're reading at Kohelis 6:10 through 6:12. That's what we're just reading.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so again, let's read the verses again, because it's really, that's what the starting point is. And I looked through the commentaries, but I did find that the Targum, who explains, he elaborates on the verses, and also Sforno were helpful. But reading them alone is just baffling. And then we also have to understand, what is this relationship between the verses that he says, he's explaining his idea in 10, where he says that, again, he says in 10, that which is already, Mashahoya Kavar and Nikrishim, that which already had its name called to it, and it's known by man, and man cannot go to judgment with one who is more powerful than him. So what are the elements over here? What is he, again, when the Torah talks, or King Solomon talks, the rabbis talk, they are trying to address an assumption. You don't have to tell a man not to try to fly by flapping his hands. I always use that example because no person, not even a fool, would think to do that. So the Torah doesn't have to tell you something which you don't assume incorrectly. But where a person does have incorrect notions, that's where the Torah has to come in. A person may feel that he can satisfy his desire to amass property, whether it belongs to him or not, Torah has to tell him not to steal, and all the different permutations. We were just discussing yesterday in Temple how there's a concept of not moving the border on your property a little bit outward, because that's an act of stealing. You're now encroaching on the territory of your neighbor, and you're minimizing his property to maximize yours, but that's an act of stealing. So there wasn't any movables that were taken underneath your possession and put into your domain, but just by moving the border itself, albeit it has to be in Israel, because that's where the borders of land were apportioned out, but if it's not in Israel, it's still an act of stealing if I do it here in the United States. But you see that man has different machinations. He has different ways of trying to achieve his instinctual drives. It could be taking money. It could be using unjust weights that we talked about in yesterday's Torah reading. It could be moving the property line. So all these areas the Torah addresses. So now what is King Solomon addressing over here? When he says that man can't go to the judge with, he can't contend with a force that's more powerful than him. And what is that doing in this verse when he is saying that everything has already had its name called to it? What does that even mean, that everything had its name called to it? And the second idea there, that, and it's known on account of the fact that he is man. But what is that? What is the idea there? What is the false notion, and what is the verse coming to correct? That which already has its name called to it and is known on account that he is man. Now let me read to you the Targum. I'll read to you the Targum here. So he says as follows. Similar but different. That which is already in the world, its name has already been called to it. Right? So it doesn't help us there. He seems to repeat that. And it is known to the sons of man from the days of Adam the first. Okay, very expansive. And all is of the decree of the word of God. And man has no ability to go enter into judgment with the owner of the world, who is stronger than him. A little more clarity, right? Again, that which is already in the world, and it's already been called by its name, it's known to man since the days of Adam the first, and all is decreed by the word of God. And there's no permission in man that he should enter into judgment with the owner of the world, who is stronger than he is. Okay. And he goes on. What does it mean, the next verse? There are many things in the world, and that they increase the futility, and what benefit is it to man? So the Targum continues. And so he says, there are many matters that increase the futility in the world. And what benefit is there to man that he should involve himself in them? So what are the matters that he's discussing? And what does this mean? They increase the futility. All right. And the last verse he talks about.
Hello?
Yes.
Verse 10, and it's saying what was already named, and it's known that he has been a man. Is it that man already knows what it's named, or is it what God already knows its name?
Well, God for sure, but it has to be applying to man.
Oh.
Meaning it's something which, or it could just mean that, meaning what does the name of something mean? When we refer to something, we call it a name. This is by Adam, when he called the name to all the animals, and then it says, and that's what its name was. So it means that whatever he named it, so So then God allowed that name to continue. He called it a zebra, so therefore it's a zebra. I mean, what do I care? If that's like a... So it can't mean that. This is when he called the names, and that was its name. It means to say that his intelligence was perfect. As Ibn Ezra says, that he was a great intellect. Adam was a great intellect. He was created with complete intelligence. So when it says he named the animals, and that was its name, it means that he perceived clearly the definition of that animal. And he named it by its unique characteristics. And since he had perfect wisdom, so therefore that was its name. That was its definition. That's what it means. When Adam named the animals, that was its definition. So the name of something means what the actual properties are of a certain thing. All right? So it could mean over here that which was already, meaning its definition was set from the days of Adam, meaning from creation. So if we talk about the days of Adam, it was known since Adam was on earth. So what does that mean? It means that the definition of everything you have in the universe was already fixed. But what do I care to know that for? Why is King Solomon telling me that? It's talking about death.
The latter part, yeah.
I mean, where it says that you can't go into judgment with God.
Latter part of 10, yeah, you can't strive with him who is stronger than he.
Well, I think one of the commentaries did say that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm taking that. It's not my original idea. I'm extrapolator pulling that out of Rashi.
Right, yeah, exactly. Francesca, you wanted to say something too?
Oh, well, from the information you gave, it sounded like we're talking about how in science we categorize things and we name them and we define them. And it just sounded like we were talking about that part of man that interacts and understands and names the world, I guess.
Right.
But
okay, so
I don't know where that's going.
Okay. Yeah, but the question is, so why does he have to tell us this? Why does he have to tell us that which was already had its definition fixed, and it was known since the time of Adam, and that man cannot enter judgment? It seems to be the last part. It's talking about death. It's a whole different idea. What does death, or beating death, have to do with the fact that that everything in the world had its fixed definition from the beginning?
Rabbi?
Yes.
If this is talking about death, then it's irrefutable. There's nothing we can do about it. How does it benefit man? And then it goes on to say in number 12, who can possibly know what is good for man in life? We could, it doesn't say it in so many words, but if we think that something is bad, how do we know that it's really bad? Even death, even so far as the whole concept of death. We're afraid of death, and death means, okay, it's over, we can't do anything more, and it's finished, and it's over. But maybe death is a blessing, really, and whatever is over is all the struggling, and the death is really the blessing. So whatever we think is a horrible thing is maybe really the blessing for us. I'm not sure if I'm explaining it right, but in other words, we don't know. It's too profound to know.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
And there are so many things that will only increase, you know, as he puts it, the futility, because we don't know. And we could just ponder and ponder and think and try to, you know, get the information out of it, and maybe we'll never know. I don't know. I just wanted to mention that.
I hear what you're saying, and I think that's a good approach. I think that's valid, and it works through for all the verses. And I don't disagree. I don't disagree. I do think there's more, though, that we can get, though, from the verses. So what you're saying, I agree with. It does follow through.
Yeah, there's much more. I just don't know how to dig into it.
Right.
Okay. I know that whenever I'll say something, you'll always correct me and say to me, look at what the words are saying to you. You know, it's the words are there for a reason, to look at the words, read the words, and try to get the meaning. But I'm struggling with this right now. I mean, even though it says further that during the short span of a pseudo existence, which should consider like a shadow, who can tell a man what will be asked to him beneath the sun? Nobody's seen what came up. We discussed this one time. I had asked you a question, Rabbi, and nobody has seen what's after. Nobody has come back and said, this is what's there waiting for us. So none of us, it's absolutely an unknown for us.
Right, and I'm not disagreeing with you this time. This time you are being true to the verses, so I'm not disagreeing.
Okay.
But I think there's more, though. I'm saying that there's another way.
Well, yeah, there's more.
And I'm not saying my way is any more. Okay. I'm not saying my way is any more correct than yours. So let's go ahead, and you'll tell me what you think of mine as well. So, but your word this time, I'm not critiquing. This time, you are staying true to the words.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay, but the question is, the specifics. You know, that which his name was already called has been that way since Adam. That's how the Targum is explaining it. All right? What is he trying to address? And why is that in the same verse as that man cannot contend with one who is stronger than him, meaning God? So yes, you could say like Rashi, like you're saying, and like Doug is saying, that you can't escape death, but what does that have to do with the first part of the verse? What you do see is you sense that there is, when he says that you can't contend with God, so what is the inclination that's fighting, that's addressing? Again, the Torah tells you you can't steal, what's the inclination that is coming to correct?
You can.
Right, it's trying to correct your inclination to steal. So if you're being told here that you can't contend with God, and that which his name is already there from the beginning of Adam, meaning that which has its definition in the world since Adam, now we start seeing a theme over here. King Solomon is trying to uncover the fact that man is trying to fight City Hall. Man is trying to manipulate and distort what the definition of the world is. Why? That's what verse 11 says. Because there's many matters that just increase the fertility. And Sforno says a beautiful explanation on this. What is it that the many matters are? He says, that which was decreed, God did not decree things that change nature, you know, possible things in nature, and it didn't remove man's free will. But there are things, there are many things that increase upon man's futility and his toil without any purpose for him that's of any consideration. Because man will increase his energies at times, and he'll expend money like those who build things to embellish their great name. People that build big houses as a testament to their wealth. He says these are the things the man is going after that increase in verse 11, because there are many matters. What are the many matters? Meaning that man is trying to have his own imagination. What are the matters? Ego, lust, fame, honor. This is what he's talking about. Because he's telling you in verse 10 that there's a fixed way the world works. This has been known since Adam, meaning based on creation, the very creation of the universe, so everything has a proper place if you follow it properly.
And creation is really for what goal? What was the reason for creation of the earth and putting man here? V'noda ashehu Adam. And it's known in as much as man is man. Perhaps meaning to say not only since the days of Adam, but these things have fixed definitions in their relationship to man, for the sake of man, that he should look at the world, and if he used intelligence, what would he be going after? Would he be going after trying to build up his name, or would the intelligent person be extremely enamored and in awe, just like Adam the first was? And he was looking at the animals and naming them and pondering the unique characteristics and the evidence of a brilliant creator whose intelligence we can't even pierce through the outer layer. So which path is man going? Is he going on the path where it's self-aggrandizement? Or is he going on the path where everything has its fixed definition, as he says in 10, that which was already called its name, and it's known to man? V'noda ashehu Adam. So either meaning from the time of Adam or from the BC, doesn't use the word ish, which also means man. Here he uses the word Adam. Adam refers back to Adam the first. There's many names you can, terms you could use to refer to references to man in Hebrew. Here he uses the word Adam. Adam is now hinting to the fact of creation. He was made from the dust, that he's a creation. And there's a path to follow as you have an intended purpose as a creation. So that intimates to us that he's talking over there about understanding what the definition is of all of what what was created from time has passed. And that's why it's good that the verse ends off by saying, and man cannot enter into judgment with one who is greater than him. That's telling you that now that there is a fixed definition and purpose to both creation and to man, so now man is best off subjugating himself and subjugating his will, abandoning his attempts at self-aggrandizement, and rather to view the intended purpose that God gave to the universe, and not to try to enter into judgment with God, who is more powerful. But he's saying this because man does have that drive. He does have that drive. That's why the next verse starts off, because. Meaning he's telling you this lesson in verse 10, because there are many imaginations and machinations that man has. Like building up great, glorious, buildings, that things that will attest to his own, puny greatness. Now we're seeing a little bit about how the verses are working together. Because that man has the world has a certain design. And man's being told by King Solomon in verse 10, don't try to go against what the plan is. There's already a fixed definition. And you can't go against God's will. Don't try to change it. It has a definition, and it cannot be changed. There is a purpose. There is a plan. But man has to be told this because of the next verse. Because he has these attempts. But these attempts, he ends up saying, that are very futile. What benefit is it to man? He now says, all those attempts that man makes, does that benefit him at all? Or is it just a waste of time? But then he says why man does this. Now he explains why man does that. He chooses the wrong path. What does he tell us the reason is in 12? For who knows what is good to man in his life, the few days of his life that are futile, that he should do them. And he is but a shadow. He's just like a shade. Who would tell man what will be after him under the sun? What is he addressing here?
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Is he commenting here that he should consider it like a shadow? A shadow doesn't really know anything. A shadow, shade comes and goes. It's it's not really something that we can hold. Say that it's as real. I don't know if it's even considered acceptable according to a Torah. A shadow is just, if we're standing in one place, it's the way the sun is reaching us and casting the shadow down. So the shadow, if we move, the shadow disappears.
What about the rest of the verse?
I'm not clear. Is it the shadow or the shade you're talking about?
Well, you're taking only one word. You're taking only one word out of the whole verse. Look at the rest of the verse. There's more that he's talking about than just a shadow. That seems to be a very isolated element of that verse.
Yeah.
Just look for something more. Look for something more.
Of a man's life.
Excuse me?
It's like a shadow.
What was that again?
We're passing through life very quickly.
Good. And there's another word that endorses that, where he says, who knows what good there would be to man the few days of his life. I don't know if your English has that, but when it says, who knows what good would be to man in his life? Mispar yemeche chevlo. The few days. That's how. All right, do you have that?
In other words, life is considered few days, not a long.
But what is he addressing? Now, what is he addressing with the words the few days or shadow, which is a fleeting thing? And then he also says at the end, who will tell man what will be after him under the sun? You have three ideas over here that are all the same. You got to pull the three ideas together.
Just simply, we don't know. We have no way of knowing. Just it's a short span. We don't know if it's good or bad. It's like a shadow. It comes and it goes. And we won't know until, it doesn't even say we'll know afterwards.
No.
We won't know until afterwards.
But why talk about the brevity of man's life now? How does this come on the heels of the previous verse?
Because we're putting too much into what life is, its futility. It comes and it goes so quickly. We don't really have that much time. And
but why say that verse here?
Because it starts with saying, excuse me, what has been was already named. But we're not able to change anything.
I don't see this following, though, based on that. This is coming after verse 11, not verse 10. Why is this following verse 11?
Because we have no way of knowing if whatever the man went through is good or bad for his life. And because it's such a short span, it's even harder to determine.
I think it's different. I think, unless somebody else wants to try too.
Please, I'm not clear on it. Thank you.
That a man thinks, thinks he knows what's good for him. But he's wrong.
But what's the element of the brevity? I mean, again, verse 11 was saying that there are many things that can increase the futility in his life. And they have real no benefit for him. And like Sforno says, like he builds up things in order to embellish his name and to gain honor. And then he says, but he does this, why? Because he doesn't know what's the good in life and for the few days that he's around. And he's like a shadow. And he doesn't know what's going to happen after him. It seems to me the theme of verse 12 is talking about that life is brief. But why does he mention the brevity of life after verse 11?
This is like, what's the, what's the benefit in the end? I mean, if life is just short and futile, then what's really the good? I mean,
then how does that relate?
Short.
How does that relate to 11? 11 is talking about where he's involved in making a name for himself and everything. And again, if 12 is telling you the life is short, that's coming to address what misconception?
The immortality.
Good.
but it's not sure it's going to last forever.
Good. Now, if you put it all together, I think we can get the answer, and that is that verse 10 is telling us that things are fixed, and they have a definition, and the real purpose is that it's to give evidence to a creator, and it's for the sake of man of knowing that. That's really it. This has been since the time of Adam the first, and it's known by man. Or it's known on account that he is man, and he has intelligence. On account that he is Adam, that he is man, he has the ability to perceive this. And that's what he should follow. And therefore, who is he to try to contend with the power greater than him? But he does try to contend. He does try to contend. Why? Because he's motivated by the inner world of fantasy and ego and striving. That's what 11 is telling you. There are these internal desires that are in conflict with the external reality that God created in order to evidence his wisdom, his great intelligence, something which is really the preferred life. But man still has many things inside of him that are increased to futilities, his fantasies. But even those fantasies have a cause. What are the causes of those fantasies? The immortality in man. It is because man has a feeling of immortality that he can spend years building a home for himself that, as Rabbi Chaitman said, you know, outlives the person. All the energy and time and money that he puts into building such a beautiful house, so it should look better than his neighbors, that it should look so impressive with a long driveway and set back in the woods. All this he does only because he feels it'll never end. So that's why he says, he starts off in verse 12, because, who knows? Meaning, who knows? Maybe I will live forever. Who knows what good is there to man in his life? But then he throws in, no, the few days of his life, of his futility. Because since man is ignorant that it's a few days that he has, and they're really like a shade. And who's going to tell man that there's going to be things after him under the sun? The idea that there being things... Mia gil adam, who tells man? Mahi yacharov, what's going to be after him? Meaning, why does man have the misconception and has this mortality? Because there's nobody telling him otherwise. There's no information about what is good. There's no moral assessment. Even though it's a few days, but he gets caught up with the fantasy. So now we see the series of these three verses make sense. There is a fixed design. That's what 10 is telling you in the beginning. Its name is already called. It has a definition. There is a purpose to the design that God created from the days of Adam. And you can even say that it's known by man. Man's intelligent. He should know these things. But yet, he still has an attempt inside to go against. But you shouldn't go against that power which is greater than you. The person should really, he's trying to tell you right from the outset, subjugate your whims, your fantasies, and recognize that you can't change the purpose that God already gave to the world. If you follow it properly and you take yourself out of the equation and your focus is not on building up yourself, but it's on looking at the external world and marveling at the wisdom, so we always cite Einstein and the Newtons of the world as those people who would lock themselves away in their laboratories for weeks on end. No need for any type of social intercourse. No need for any type of fanfare. Their enjoyment was in seeing new ideas and how the world operates. Just like Maimonides says, what's the path to love God? It's interesting. In the Mishnah Torah, he says, not a word about Torah. He says, the path to love God, study the universe. Of course, in his book of the commands, where he lists all 613, there he includes. But in terms of man as a natural being, prior to Torah, there was no real Torah. There were a few commands, that was it. And that was enough. That was God's plan. Man would exist on earth with his intelligence. He had a complete tool that he could be autonomous in terms of discovery and having the most beautiful and fulfilling life if he would be pondering the world and involved in wisdom, and the self was not the focus. So that's verse 10. But the reason why we have to be told this is because of verse 11. There are many things that are futile, and we get involved in. That's verse 11. But that's all because of verse 12. Because why do we get involved in these futilities? Because we have a sense of immortality. If, however, a person would not feel he's going to live forever, then he's going to look at what he does here on earth as was a waste of time. Why should I spend years building a house when I could use those years in what's going to be long-lasting, meaning the next world? Okay, let me stop here and pause for any questions or comments.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Yeah, I have to say thank you. Because that clarifies it. Thank you.
Sure, my pleasure.
It is very confusing. And the part that I was getting confused about was I wasn't really taking into the whole picture. The three sections together, I was sort of isolating them into the one. But I know there's a short span, and I know that Hashem is saying that we should understand that. Well, Kohelet is saying actually here that we should look at this, that life is a short span, and we really don't know what's good for us. We can say we want this and we want that. And even the Vilna Gaon had said this to a person years ago, and the person asked a question. May I say it? It's a quick little synopsis of this. The rabbi was asking, the man was asking if he should make his house more beautiful and buy a car and put it in front. He didn't want to because he was afraid his neighbors would be jealous. And the rabbi said to him, what makes you think they'll be jealous? Well, I'll have the car and the beautiful home. He said, well, let me ask you, do you know Shas? Do you know this farm? Do you know this? Do you know that? And every time the rabbi asked him, the man kept saying, no, he didn't know. He said, what do the neighbors have to be jealous of? The fact that you have a house and a car means nothing. It's beautiful that you were able to explain this. And I couldn't pull that out of my brain. I had heard this years ago, and I'm sorry. But it seems to come right into what you were saying. What is important, really? What is really important?
Right. But more specific, we see the whole way that the King Solomon unfolds this. It's
right.
not to be oversimplifying what's important. We have to, again, the lesson would be we're better off if we have, we gain more, I should say, if we now see clearly what he was doing with the verses, and we see how he strings the verses together by starting off 11 and 12 with the word because. So now we know that these are related. So that helps us in terms of understanding, because it's the most important thing when you start to learn, the verses, is to know where does this section start and where does it stop. If you include too much or if you leave out something, so then you're not getting the whole picture. But here you see that he's stringing the verses together. So that's the first thing in terms of a method of learning. And then also to look at all the nuances in the verses and to take the time and see the commentaries and it's a patient approach. So I think what we come away with
is the sense of me and everybody. It doesn't say because in my space here.
Yeah.
And I find it very difficult to read something and to try to grasp the meaning and dig into it. I need help with it. I guess that's why we have rabbis or Hashem to help us see what we're not seeing, because it was very hard for me to dig into it and pull out what you pulled out.
Right. Well,
thank you.
Yeah. I mean, again, studying Torah and having having a method. I have to give credit to having studied under Rabbi Shade, Rabbi Mann, 30 years, and that's not something which, it ends. You continue learning, but to cultivate the mind, to cultivate the thinking, and to see how, and they've studied for decades under great minds like, Joseph Soloveitchik and Moshe Feinstein, and then again, we have Sforno, and we have a wealth of information. So it takes time to cultivate our own ability. So, it's just a continual process. Okay.
Do the other students also feel the same way as I do, that it's very hard to really grasp it on your own, that you need somebody to make it clearer, to explain it? I mean, there's words there. We know the English language, but somehow I found it so hard to understand.
Yeah, it is hard. It's hard. It was
without
hard for me.
You helping us along.
It was hard for me as well.
I love the other students feel the same way. Anyway, good. We got there. Could I ask a question? Are we finished with this section now?
No. I want to see if anybody. I want to see if anybody has questions or comments on this.
Okay.
Is everybody else clear on this? Any questions?
I'm here.
Go ahead.
I think it's good.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Okay, so it's clear to everybody? Everybody's got it?
Yes.
Okay, so Rivka, you said you had a question on something else?
Yeah, in reference to the Jewish Times of this week, the letters from the people who wrote in, Josh had, I don't know if it's our Josh, but there was a gentleman, Josh, wrote in something about the person who is a convert would not be considered as a full convert. I was very disturbed by that. And my question basically is, at Ruth is the mother of...
Well, before you go to Ruth, let me make sure you have the idea correct. What is your concept that you feel is questionable? That was in the Jewish Times.
Okay, maybe I didn't read it correctly, but in the Jewish Times of this week, the question was asked about whether or not a person who is a convert, let me get it and read it properly.
Well, I know what you're talking about. Let me tell you what the idea was, and you'll tell me if you had it right. The idea, the question that Josh, okay. This is a different Josh, not Josh Plank, Edens, and he wrote in, and he wanted to know, because he heard that converts would not be accepted in the Messianic time. That was his question. Is that true or not? That was his question.
Right.
So I wrote back, okay. And I said, according to a rabbi in the Gemara, in the Talmud, converts will not be accepted in the Messianic times, just like in the days of King David and King Solomon, converts were also not accepted. And they explained the reason why they were not accepted was because the authorities in King David and King Solomon were concerned that they were not converting because of pure reason, but they had ulterior motives. What was the ulterior motives in King David's time? Because of power. They feared war, and King David was winning all the battles, so people wanted to convert to be on the winning side. And other times, in King Solomon's time, he was wealthy, and it was the greatest kingdom ever, so people were converting for that reason. So either because of the fame or the wealth. So therefore, they did not allow converts then because it wasn't pure. And that's what the Talmud says. Similarly, in the Messianic times, when the Jews will be recognized as being the proper religion and all else will be considered false, so then people want to join, you know, the people that are on top. So the verse is quoted. The rabbi quotes a verse in the Talmud, and he says, what is this based on? How do we know that this is a principle of Torah, that we do not accept the converts in the future? It's because God said that there will be a big attraction, that the people will want to convert in the future, and that they'll try to do it. But he says, only those that converted when I was not with you, God says, meaning when God is not with the Jews, meaning the times of exile. So only those people who attached themselves to the Jewish nation and converted prior to the Messianic era are really going to be accepted and will be considered Jews, because they are doing it even while the Jews are oppressed. That means despite the oppression of the Jew, they're attached to the ideas of the Torah. Then they will have the lot. The verse ends off by saying, Yipol, they will fall into the lot of the Jew because they attached themselves properly, despite the fact that the Jew was downtrodden in the times of exile now. But if those try to attach themselves to the Jew in the future, they didn't try to attach themselves to the Jewish nation when the Jews were impoverished or downtrodden, now they're just doing it because they want popularity reasons, they're not going to be accepted because it's not a true conversion. The commentaries also, however, say that there were times where certain people came before certain rabbis and they viewed them individually. So I didn't conclude by saying that I know what for sure is going to take place, because it seems to be another view is that there were individuals that were viewed as really being have no ulterior motive, and the rabbi saw that there was no ulterior motive, so they accepted the conversion. So until it actually unfolds, I don't know if we'll have a real definitive answer to the question, but that was the question. Now you tell me what
I understand now. Okay, that makes sense. And you know, Rabbi, if I may add, even to this day, in our times, it's not acceptable to convert if, for instance, a young girl and boy want to marry, and the boy wants to convert to Judaism. He is not accepted unless he wants to convert to Judaism for the right reason. Is it just because he wants to marry the girl, or is it because he has learned that Torah and he wants to learn Torah? They put so many obstacles, the rabbis, that is, put obstacles in front, and there is certain...
That's not true.
Not accept the convert at all.
I actually spoke to a rabbi.
Even if you do convert, possibly for the right reasons, they don't accept them at all. Even in today's times.
I actually spoke to Rev. I think it was Rev. David Feinstein, if I'm not mistaken, he said that even if a person's interested in marriage, and that's why the conversion takes place. What the rabbis will do is they will look at the person at the time he wants to convert and assess whether or not he's doing it for the right reasons or not. So it's a simple formula.
Okay. Okay, so it's done on an individual basis.
Right.
Oh, okay. I see. Okay. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Now, I couldn't understand that.
All right, no problem.
The question was in reference to Ruth.
Okay.
Now, Ruth was a convert, and
right.
Yet she's the mother of Mashiach.
Yeah, this has no bearing.
It doesn't come into play here. This is totally different.
Right.
That was why I was confused.
Right. It's an important point that the Messiah himself is a descendant of a convert. So that would seem to be on the surface. Well, if the Messiah himself is a descendant of a convert, so why would it be that in the days of the Messiah, you wouldn't accept converts? But you see, it's two different ideas now.
Right, exactly. I see that clearly now. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, any other questions or comments?
Rabbi, I have a question about this week's parsha.
Go ahead.
That in Acharei, it's talking about the Yom Kippur service, and then it starts talking about not eating the blood, which I understand how those are connected. And then it goes into the laws of sexual purity, which it just seems like a strange place. It doesn't seem to belong with that parsha.
You mean, what's the continuum?
I'm sorry?
You want to know what the continuum is?
Yeah.
Let's see, that's at the end, right? At the end
yes.
of the parsha, it talks in Leviticus... 18:6, right. Okay, that's at the end. And isn't the beginning where it talks about the Yom Kippur, right? In 16, it's talking about the Yom Kippur laws, right?
Yeah.
So you want to know why it's in the same parsha? Is that your question?
Yes, it seems like a strange transition.
Well, isn't there more that's in between? It doesn't go straight from Yom Kippur to the sexual, is it? Let's see where it goes.
It goes from Yom Kippur to not eating blood, which seems at least somewhat related, and then it goes into forbidden relationships.
Let's see. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Shabbos Shabbosun. Right, so it ends off the Yom Kippur at the end of 16. That's where it ends off. Then it goes and it transitions into if a Jew is going to slaughter a sacrifice outside the camp and he does not bring the sacrifice to the temple. So that'll be considered like blood on him, like a very, very big sin. And he'll be cut off from the people. That means he has no world to come. Why? So the verse explains in 17:5, in order that the Jews bring their sacrifices that they sacrifice to on the face of the field, instead they should bring them to God, to the temple. and they should sacrifice their peace offerings there to God. And then the priest will then take of the blood and sprinkle it towards the temple and smoke up the fat as a pleasant odor to God. Why? In order, and here's the important verse, 17:7, that the Jews should no longer sacrifice to the Seirim, to demons, meaning they had a practice where they would do things in the middle of the desert. That's why God wants them to do whatever. If they're going to bring sacrifices, it has to be to Him. Okay, so that's an important verse with it. Below, Yisbechu Od, as if a handless game, they should no longer sacrifice to demons. That they had this imagination. And Ramban says to the demons. That's how he translates the words to Iram. It could mean goats or it means demons. And he says fools will imagine these things to look like goats, but they're really just phantoms of the mind. So you see that it talks about in the beginning. What is the? It says that after the death of Aaron's sons. So what they do, they offered a sacrifice that they weren't commanded. They came up with their own ideas of how to serve God. And actually, the whole institution of Yom Kippur was a response to the gold calf, which was also an expression of a person's own subjective desire to relate to God on his own terms. That is prohibited. Relating to God on your own terms, that's idolatry, if not bordering on it. So the whole institution of Yom Kippur was to correct the flaw. And you see that you have the Yom Kippur sacrifices that part of it is that the Kohen, the high priest, goes in only once a year to the Holy of Holies, and he has to smoke up the room. Why does he smoke up the room when he goes to the Holy of Holies? Because you might think that when you're in the Holy of Holies, now you have closer proximity to God. No. And that's why when God appeared, it was always in cloud. And that's why Maimonides says that there's a tradition that when God had revelation at Sinai, it was cloud. Cloud is always there to show you one idea, to smoke up the room, the pillar of cloud, to show you that there's a veil between man and God. It is impossible for man to understand God. And that was the sin of Aaron's sons, that they thought they could come up with a way. No, you can't come up with a way to approach God. You have to follow his ideas. And that's very much what we would study today. The man cannot contend with God. Everything has a fixed design and purpose. It's very similar to the verse that we did today. Similar message. So you have that, and that's why the following after the whole laws of Yom Kippur, which teach the ideas of how to relate to God and to accept the fact that you can't know God, that's why that's the primary practice was the high priest going into the Holy of Holies and smoking up the room, meaning in this Holy of Holies, where it housed the tablets of stone that Moses got on top of Sinai, the sapphire tablets of the Ten Commandments. So when the Kohen went into that room, he had to smoke it up. He had to show there's a veil. Even here, there's a veil between me and God. So then it makes sense why then transitions in 17, and it talks about how another thing that people did, which was an attempt to relate on their own, and they would take the animals out into the middle of the desert. And that was how they sacrificed the demons. They had this idolatrous practice. So that's very much related to this. Okay. And then it goes on from where? It says, eating blood. That was another part of the sacrifices. And Maimonides explains in the... He says that now in 17:10. Any man from the house of Israel, or from any ger, any convert amongst them, that would eat blood, I will put my face against that person that eats the blood. And I will cut him off again. The person is cut off, no world to come. Complete obliteration of that person's soul. What did they used to do? So Maimonides says that there was a practice, I think there was the Sabians, that they would sit around a pot of blood, they would kill an animal, collect the blood, and they would assume that the demons would come and eat the blood, and this would form a camaraderie between the demons and people and humans, and this would protect them somehow. It would be a fortuitous thing to have the demons liking us. So we make a dinner for them for the blood. Or we might eat the blood ourselves. So this, again, was an ancient practice. And you see, blood still has very much significance today. You know, vampires, all these different fantasies. So here also is another practice of following idolatrous modes of operation. So still all on the same theme. It started from the very beginning of the parsha, right? The very beginning of the Torah section of Achremos. And therefore, there's a command in 13 and 14 that you should cover the blood when you slaughter an animal. Covering the blood is now a demonstration. Nothing. It's just blood. It pours in the ground after you slit the animal's neck. That's how you properly slaughter an animal so you can eat it. You're allowed to eat meat now. But when the blood comes out, cover it. Don't collect it. Don't fall into the same idolatrous practices. Okay? All right. And then he goes on to in 18, it starts off by warning us against going after the practices of Egypt. You shouldn't do like the practices, or like the land of the Canaanite people. All idolatrous. Again, continue on the same thing. Okay, now comes the whole thing about the sexual prohibitions. And that's in 18:6. So now it seems to be this great transition, Jim, that you're talking about. So what is going on over here? Good question. Okay, now. So if you look, there is an interesting clue that it gives. Like, for example, in verse 12, 18:12. So it says, the nakedness of the sister of your father you should not reveal, meaning you shouldn't sleep with your aunt. All right? The sister of your father. This is the relative of your father, right? That's how it has it there in English? But why does that have to tell you that it's a relative of your father? Right? It's someone who's close to your father. Oh, we're getting a hint now. What's going on over here? Or if it says in 8, right, just backing up a little bit, 18:8, the nakedness of the wife of your father, you should not reveal. This is the nakedness of your father. What does that tell me? Why is it qualified? Just tell me, don't do this, don't do that. Shake the lulav and the etrog, or put on tefillin, or put on tzitzis. Here it says, why does it just say, don't sleep with the wife of your father, whether it's your mother, or whether it's your stepmother. But then it says, no, one more thing it says, it is the nakedness of your father. What is that adding? And you see the very first verse says, any man, any close relative to his skin, he should not come close to reveal. I am God. So right at the beginning it says, Kol She'er Bisaro. Anyone that is of close proximity to him in flesh, meaning, what does it mean close proximity to him in flesh? Meaning a relative, right? Flesh means you're existence as a human being is due to a certain relation of other people, your father, your mother, and so on. So you see the word se'er. It's not just telling you. See, I'm just trying to show you how you can start looking for the clues. Look what it says in 10, another interesting one. The nakedness of the daughter of your son, your granddaughter, or the daughter of your daughter, you should not reveal. You cannot sleep with your granddaughter. Why? Because this is your nakedness. Wow. What does that mean? So, what's going on over here, it would seem to imply that it's telling you a qualification where you can't have relations with these certain individuals. because it's an attempt to relate to them in the wrong way. Your father's wife, that's really your father you're going after. It's uncovering what the attraction is over here. What is the motive to go after these people? There's plenty of people that you can have intercourse with. You can have, there are plenty of partners that are permissible. Why does a person go after these? So the Torah is telling you, you're going after your father. There's a unhealthy attachment over here. You're viewing the father is really the cause of your existence, but now you're relating to it purely in a sexual fashion? That's wrong. There's something twisted here. And it could very well be that this is part of the instinctual, and that's what caused the idolatrous acts of sacrificing in the desert and eating blood, and what Aaron's two sons did by coming up with their own ideas of how to relate to God. It's derived from base instinctual sources. So now we can perhaps see why the sexual is now brought into this parsha too, this Torah section. Because there are certain primary components that deal with, that operate. You have the appetitive drive, like even Freud said this, the most primary desires in man are the appetite, food, and the sexual. And you see this whole parsha talked about, eating of the blood, right? And then it talks about the sexual. So perhaps that's why. But if you go into it more, you can see that it's exposing a bit what the different attempts are. Like, you shouldn't have intercourse with your granddaughter because it's really your descendant. It's your nakedness that you now. You have a twisted view as to what the definition of your granddaughter is. You're supposed to be creating, progeny. And what are you doing? You're relating to your descendants. You're really supposed to be establishing more descendants that you should populate the earth. That's God's will. But now you're relating to that object as just a satisfaction of your lust. So it's a grave distortion.
Rabbi?
Yes, Doug.
We once discussed that prior to the giving of the Torah, that relations between close relatives were allowed, sister, brother, and that kind of thing.
That's right.
So I'm curious as to why, I mean, based on your rationale, you're saying the reason for these prohibitions is against lust. But I guess two questions. Why suddenly would it be okay before Sinai, but not okay after Sinai? And number two, if you're saying, well, this goes back to being close to the father, well, if you're going to have relations with your aunt, that's not necessarily because I'm trying to, relate to my father, and there has to be a line drawn, so, what about my second aunt or my second cousin twice removed? I mean, there's, if you go far enough out the relative chain, there has to be a line drawn, and so what's the rationale of where the line got drawn? You see my question?
Yes. That doesn't bother you as much as your first question. Your first question is good because even Moses' father married his aunt.
Rabbi, weren't there, under Malachite law, certain incestuous relationships are forbidden now?
They are or they are not?
What's that?
Repeat your question. They are forbidden or they're not forbidden?
They are.
Okay.
I don't think it's, I think there's additional ones that, for Jews, I don't remember off the top of my head, what the ones are exactly, but,
Well, loosely, I mean, we could say, and keep in mind also that how did Adam have populate the world? It was only he and his wife and their children. So it must be that their children, they had incestuous relationships. And actually, it does say that. The son married the daughter. And that was all right. So in certain, you see, it's not an absolute. But when the Torah is given, so we have to understand that the Torah is now trying to achieve a level of perfection, whereas the Noahide laws, as we said, in a quarter hour shade are just the minimum necessary that you reserve your entitlement to life. But it's not a system of perfection. So we could say that although certain things were permitted in the past, and certain relationships were permitted, but now in terms of trying to achieve a level of perfection, so now more laws were given. It actually says that the Jews cried by the family when the Torah was given. But the commentaries say, it doesn't mean by the family, it means on the matters of family, that now they can no longer marry their sister or so on. So those things, see, that's, the, I think Rambam even explains it, that that's really where the strongest attraction is. Because those are the ones that are around you most of the time, and the heart grows attached. Now there's a taboo today, which is, seems to have evolved, which is an interesting thing. You know what the Talmud says? The Talmud says at the end of Tractate Brachos that if a person has a dream that he sleeps with his mother or his sister, he should anticipate greater wisdom in life. Why? What does it mean? It means to say that that is a natural attraction. And that's why when a person looks for a mate, according to Freud, they try to find a replication, a replacement for the parent of the opposite sex. A girl is looking for a replacement to the father, and the boy is looking for a replacement to the mother. And it even says by Isaac that when he finally married Rivka, that he was comforted for his mother. It says it open in the verse. So you see that that's a natural inclination, and that was something which was permitted. And if a person has that, dreams about that, why should he anticipate greater wisdom in life? Because he's not inhibited. He's not affected by the taboos of society. It may be something and that the Torah even prohibits, but he doesn't say, I don't have the feeling. So that's a very rare individual, that he's not so repressed, that he can be very true. If a person is very honest with himself and he has dreams that he's having intercourse with a sister, that means he has a very healthy personality. His mind is very open. He's not repressed. And that's the mind that will see greater wisdom in life, because he's not a repressed individual. So to answer your question, Doug, things were permitted. There was nothing that was necessary in terms of, that was not a breach in terms of the minimum level of existence. It was even allowed by Adam, and you see that people did it, and Moses' very father and married his aunt. But after the Torah is given, now we're trying to reach a level of perfection, which was not there, it wasn't in place before.
Rabbi?
Let me just finish off.
And Rabbi, may I ask a question in relation to this?
One second.
In reference to an uncle marrying a niece, that's permitted, is that?
One second. So Doug, yep. In terms of the other question, how far does it go? Then we have to look at the, we have to look and see if we come with a definition. Why is it stopped by, you know, the let's say your mother has a brother and he marries somebody, but then he dies. So now that would be permitted because it's too far removed. What defines what's too far removed? That, you know, what's too? How do we define that? That we'll have to give thought to that. I can't answer that right now. Okay, Rifki had a question about uncle marrying a niece. We have to see what the connections are, and we'll have to.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, Doug. I'm sorry, Doug. I know of cases where uncles marry their nieces, and I never saw it anywhere that it wasn't allowed. In the parsha, I don't remember reading that was incorrect.
All right, well, you have to go through the verses. The verses are there from 18:6 yeah. through the end over there. You can take a look and see which ones. But you look at the, yeah, you
no,
see that there's...
I didn't, so that means it's okay.
You have to go through it. I don't have all these on my fingertips right now. Okay?
Okay, no problem. Thank you.
Yeah, I found what the forbidden relations are for the Noahides. If I could read them real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's from the Mishnah Torah, you know, Laws of Kings 9:5. So the non-Jews forbidden to engage in six illicit sexual relations with his mother, with his father's wife, with a married woman, with his maternal sister, with a male, or with an animal.
All right, so stepsister is a sister to a father's, all right. And, yeah. And but he could marry a son or daughter? It sounds like the
court. Hey, it's not listed.
That's interesting. Who authored that? That's the Rambam you're reading?
What's that?
That's Maimonides?
Yeah, I'm reading it from the Law of the Kings. Yeah.
So that means his daughter is all right, and his granddaughter, and niece, and so on. So it's only his. Read him again.
His mother, his father's wife, a married woman, his maternal sister, a male, and an animal.
So it's only addressing what a man can do, evidently.
Right.
Perhaps because the man is...
Oh, you know, I don't know if the daughter would be forbidden to marry her father. I don't know.
It seems to be, yeah, because he's not prohibiting the daughter or the son. So it'd have to be two ways. That seems to be permitted. So it would be interesting to define why those. But you see that those are... but the aunt was not prohibited, right?
Right.
So you see that was completely permissible in the times of Moses' father. There were all Noahides back then. Moses was Noahide.
You'd have the issue with Adam and Hava. I mean, apparently, their sons would have to marry their maternal sisters.
Well, that was permitted because there was a separate condition there.
Right.
So I think perhaps going back to Jim's question, we may see a full picture now how the whole section unfolds. So you see it's all dealing with the instinctual. So naturally that the very prime instinctual area of sex has to be addressed.
It's interesting that section 2 look at, it's talking about sexual relations, and verse 21 there, I think it is, talks about Molech.
Right. That is interesting. There is actually Maimonides has, I believe, in the Guide for Perplexed, we're actually looking for yesterday, I couldn't locate it, I think he puts together Molech or idolatry and eating blood. And he says these are the only two places in the Torah where God says, I'll place my face against that man. So I have to find that. Maybe if I find it, we can take that up next week. So what is so severe about that? I'll have to go into that again. All right. All right, so maybe we'll wrap it up here. I know you're going to have the class going on in 10 minutes, so we'll pick up next week. And if you have any subsequent questions or thoughts on this, give me a call or email during the week, all right?
Yep. All right, thanks, Rabbi.
Okay, everybody.
Thank you so much, Rabbi. Be well.
Okay, have a good week, everybody.
Have a good week, everybody.
You too.